elevate.
Hey guys, welcome to the Elevate Podcast. This is episode 23, and today we have a guest on. We have Sean Fryers, who is on the podcast with us. Sean, how are you doing?
Good, folks. How are you?
Basically, we brought Sean on because Sean has a really interesting story, and we thought, you know what, we need to let people hear this, like, because what he has to say and where he's been in his journey is kind of fantastic, like, to be honest. And where he's at right now, not at the end of your journey, I was going to say the end of your
start
journey.
Start of it.
It's a totally different place than where he was a few years back. So, Sean, if you want to introduce yourself just a wee bit and tell people a wee bit about you.
Sean Fryers, ex-professional footballer. Now working with homeless people with addictions as a support worker and assistant manager of Institute in the Irish Premier League. So,
brilliant.
Excellent.
Excellent. Thing.
What we're going to do is find out, like, about Sean's story now, because Sean, obviously, being an ex-professional footballer with what clubs?
Liverpool, Ipswich, and then back here, Derry Cities, Cloughonvilles, Institute, Dungannon. There's a more clubs in Tiger Woods, aye.
Yeah. I know Sean from kind of growing up around Gaelic as well, too, and he was kind of one of those guys you went, how is he that good at football, especially when you're trying to be a better footballer and you couldn't actually do it. But everybody knew who Sean was in and around Gaelic for that football reason. So, Sean, if you want to give us even a wee bit of a insight into how you actually got started as a footballer.
I don't really know when it was, but when people take teddy bears to bed, I had a football apparently. This is coming from my parents and stuff. I've always had a ball at my foot. Growing up in Gaelic, back in the days, I don't do it no more. We used to play matches in the street, used to kick balls against the wall. No, they really love the game, and that was it. And I signed for Foyle Harps with Gerry Doherty at 6 years of age, and from then on, it's been non-stop. Even now, still, even through part of my story and the ups and downs, football has always been involved in it. So it's in me, like.
It's still there now. Yeah. Even to the day.
Where did that come from? Was it like, has there been a history of footballers in your family? Your dad played football, didn't he?
There's a fight in our house, right? So my dad was a goalkeeper. He's trying to take some credit
right
now, but apparently my ma was a really good footballer.
Right.
So I'm going to give it to my ma because I'm not a goalkeeper. So Bernie takes the credit on that one. Like.
So where did it all kind of escalate? Like, you played for Foyle Harps. How long were you there for?
I was Foyle Harps from, like I say, from I was 60, I was 15, then I moved away. Foxy knows, you played in the D&D, you were Mollusk every year, which all the scouts used to come and watch. And then that was it. I think I had, just playing through the years, I think I had my first trial at 10. It's just mad now looking back.
I went
to Man United at 10. And then I was at City and Man City and then all them big clubs, and it was from 10 years of age, day 15 until I moved away full time.
Yeah.
Every school holiday, I was away. But then when I signed for Liverpool then, I signed for Liverpool 14. And from 14 on then, Liverpool used to fly me over to Liverpool every Thursday.
Brilliant.
And fly me back in every Sunday night. So I had half a week in Liverpool. And it's mad because, like, I have kids, 16 and 17. Mm. So when I say I don't know, 14, I was a baby. Do you know what I mean?
I was
so,
still waiting, exactly.
How did that feel? Like, you know, especially for somebody that age, like growing up around Gaelic, playing football all the time, constantly. And then all of a sudden, Man United's knocking on the door. Liverpool's knocking on the door. Like, you're probably that young, you don't really grasp it.
No. And because I think people seen the talent that I had from so young, it was nearly the norm then.
Right.
And I don't mean that in an arrogant kind of way, because one thing I'm not a special with football is that I was just, it's what I've done. I got up, I went to school, I played with my mates, climbed trees, collected for bonfire nights, had fights with other streets, all the things you do as a kid. But then I went to Man United and Liverpool and Arsenal and all these teams there on the weekend, and that was just the norm.
It just seemed the norm.
Just the norm, aye.
Didn't seem like there was anything else that you ever wanted to do at that age. It was always just football.
That was it. I was all on you. And to be completely honest with you, up until maybe 6 or 7 years ago, that's all. But it was all I was ever was, or all I was ever associated as.
Sure,
do you know what I mean?
Football.
Aye. Whereas now,
you're something else.
I'm something else. I'm more than just a footballer.
Well, like this young kid from Gaelic, like, what was it like when you first seen, you know, the superstars, like you seen on the TV? What was it like kind of going to that place like Liverpool and kind of seeing the big names in person?
It was scary. Like, you know, you see them on TV and people think that they're untouchable, like they're the movie stars and stuff, and you're kind of, I know you're a wee better than all of them. And so it was scary, but not the scary, it was kind of just exciting. But and then you kind of, when you're going over, I mean, that first time, you're kind of, am I good enough? Because I'm just a wee lad from Killia. Mm. People's telling me I'm, but I'm good enough. And then I quickly realised then that I was, while I was there with Emmons, you know, so.
I mean, Homer being over with City, when he was still kind of over and back way, and still playing with Boscos, and like, he couldn't wait to come back and tell him the stories and all those players that he met and stuff. Just seemed something that was like unreal.
Homer will say the same thing. I think most people, it just becomes part of norm. Like, so my mates then stopped asking me, what's he like? And they're all, where's my tracksuit? Yeah. Where's my boots? Yeah. Where's my training kit? I had the whole Gaelic kit out in Liverpool gear and stuff.
Even if you weren't a Liverpool fan, you got a Liverpool
fan. And do you know what? It was all too big for them. Because
then
it was like the one size fits all. So we were running around with big, massive clothes on us.
So, moving away then, what was like the first, like you moved away, signed for Liverpool, what, 15, 16?
Aye. Yeah.
And what was that experience like, actually leaving home and going over to play in England?
I was dreading it, but excited, because all on weekends that I was away, even though I knew that I was going on the Thursday and coming back on the Sunday for a couple of years, every Thursday I cried going.
Aye.
Every single Thursday. So I knew it was going to be tight, because our family's really, really tight, and my group of mates are really tight. I am a homebird, like. So I couldn't wait to get going, or I really, really couldn't, because when I was there, I loved it, but I always cried going, and I couldn't wait to get home. So it was just, it was a mixture of excitement and worry.
What do you think is like one of the most important things for, say, somebody is 15, 16, heading away to sign for a team across the water? Like, what's the most important thing that you could probably, thinking back, give somebody in terms of information they could use to settle themselves in? What really worked for you, or what was missing, do you think?
As a parent, me, myself, now, I would say to parents, make sure you're in the right surroundings, make sure you've got the right people around them who's going to guide them, check in on them, you know, because it is a glamour world when you look at it, but you start training at 10 o'clock and you're finished at 12 o'clock.
Aye. You're left to your own.
And then you're left to your own, and we were in digs, like I say, like 15, 16, you're a baby, a kid, and you're left there, and you've got a homesick and stuff and all, so. But again, that's the dream. So yeah, I know people turn around and say they shouldn't go away till they're older and this and that. And I get what they're saying. So as a daddy, I say, my kids going to university. But you know what I'm saying? I say they can go when they're 40. So it's kind of that balance. But if that's a dream, that's a dream. Do you know what I mean? You can't take that away. So, and if you're good enough and you're surrounded by the right people and, you know, you have a chance. So it's just, I think, finding. I think people think, go to the best club because it looks good. It's not always the case. It's going to the right place, the right area that you're comfortable in, and having the right people around you, Kennedy.
Be nurtured.
Or to be the parent away from parents. Does someone say, right, and I clip your tail here? Because at that age, you need your tail clubbed. Do you know what I mean? And when you don't have it, it's easy just to crack on. Like.
Yeah, and be easy led, I suppose.
Yeah.
Well, was it a dream, though? Like, I know the football inside was a dream, but outside of that, like, when did it kind of... What was it like? Tell me. Like, what was the actual life like? Because you said it's glamorous, and obviously coming from Derry and going from a place like Gaelic, even to somewhere where it's like literally, but somewhere where it's millionaires. Like, literally, there's people probably pulling up in Ferraris and Bentleys, and you're probably in your bike or whatever. And fucking. So, when was it like? What was it outside of that? Like, what was life actually like there?
It was tough. Away from the club, because at the club it's great, you're focused, you're up, you're training, you know, you're preparing for all the things that you had to do, you're surrounded with all the boys, the banter's good, it's that, you know, that, you know, the changing mentality, you know, that's great. It's afterwards, that's a tough part. It's when you come back to digs on your own, or you're trying to kill time. And you know, Liverpool having such a big fan base from here, every single weekend there was people over from Derry or Ireland, and they're all, can you get me tickets, can you get me tickets, can you get me tickets? And I couldn't wait to get people tickets because I was getting company. Do you know what I mean?
Course,
so you're, so it's don't get me wrong, it's amazing. I've travelled the world with it and stuff on that. But just looking back now in hindsight, which is a great thing, I suppose, is you look back and you go that it's there's a lot more to it than just let's go play football. Nah. And I think me becoming a parent really opened my eyes to looking at it in a different way. So what knows what I put my parents through?
Because
like,
you would have grew up fast, like, too. That's the other thing.
Well,
because you're open to everything. Like, you were living on your own, essentially, even though it was digs, obviously, but you were not left to your own devices, but you were kind of forced into that position where you had to grow quick.
Well,
I was... You learned to be independent.
Well, I was in digs. I was 18, and then I bought my own house, and then I had my family and a wife, and all my mates will probably still tell you I still haven't grown up. Do you know what I mean? So it's, and I just think I ever won, and that's alright, because you know there's a good we say that.
Of course, there
it's
is
just
I think we all still feel we're 18.
Aye, 100%. No matter what. You know what I mean? You have to enjoy stuff and that. But it's just, it's you have to make decisions that you probably wouldn't have to if you were still at home, you know, so a wee bit earlier. But I know, good and bad.
So what about, like, I know that you played along with Stephen Gerrard, Michael Owens, who else was in and around your...
Jimmy Carragher, David Thompson, all England internationals. We had a really, really, really good youth team, really good. We won the FA Youth Cup. We beat West Ham in the final over two legs. We beat them, I think, 5-2 or something, 5-3, maybe it's going a long way back. And they had... Ferdinand, Lampard, Michael Carrick, Joe Cole. So they had some top players, but we blew them away. We were something else. Like, we'd gone to a European tournament and that as well, and beaten Barcelona's, Juventus, Bayern Munich and stuff. You know, we were the top of the tree. Like, so,
could you see, like, even at that stage, like, could you see the differences in the likes of, say, Michael Owen, Stephen Gerrard and stuff? Was there anything different that stood out to them compared to the other players? In terms of what they were doing, preparation or focus?
The players that I mentioned were at Lawshaw, which is like, you go there and you finish your last 2 years of school, so it's an England-based thing. So the top players go there and they go and they do their schooling, and it's proper structured. You know, it's really, really good. So you can see the discipline on them.
Right.
You could see how good the players they were, but you could see the discipline on them. Stephen Gerrard, who for me, and people disagree with, for me, is the best midfielder I think there's ever been, just because of what he'd done on his own. Basically, he carried Liverpool for 10 years, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you knew he was going to be good, but not that
level.
Not as, I knew he would play for Liverpool and England. You could see that, it was evident. But how good he was, and how better he became, how quickly, was purely down to his discipline and dedication. Mm. He was phenomenal. And they had that, whereas I didn't have that. And I have programmes in the house, and they're talking about, you know, next kid in the block who's to come through, because you had Jamie Redknapp, who'd seen young lads going on the team, Robbie Fowler had just broke through, McManaman had come through, and then the next kid to come through was Sean Fryers, Michael Owen, Stephen Gerrard. So I was top on that tree. I just didn't have that discipline. I just didn't have that.
Do you think obviously that's something that's missing with underage football here, in terms of, like, the coaching aspect, the discipline, the mindset around it all?
100%. Now, I know the AFA now have got this, they're trying to do a similar thing now as well, which is great to see. I think we're a wee bit behind it. Well, I know we're a bit behind the times over everywhere else, but at least there's steps going forward. You know, it's like I say, it's not just about the development of footballers. See, football is 90% in your head. That's, and I'm sure, listen, it's the same in most jobs. It's the same, like, use boys at gym and stuff and all. It's having that drive, it's having that determination, having that, it's to see your vision, it's to know where you want to get to. It's like, not just about turning up and playing. Do you know what I mean?
You see the difference with a player when they're on form, but just that bit of confidence, and then when they lose confidence, it's not that they've lost the ability, it's just that difference in confidence.
See, when you're confident, you run faster, you run longer, you feel stronger. You can't wait to do long runs. You can't wait to do all the things.
You want the ball all the time.
Do you know what I mean? And so psychologically, it's huge. It's massive. It's massive. And I suppose, you know, being prepared. Like they did at Lillishall, and they do in them other countries, they do prepare them a lot younger. But again, like I say, they're trying to make that steps for it to happen here, which can only it's not just benefit them as people or as players, it's benefit them as people and stuff, and that I to take them forward, because there's only a small drop in the ocean of people who make it.
That's right.
That's what happens after. Are you prepared to deal with
exactly.
To deal with, like.
So what happened then, Sean? So you were with Liverpool for how long? A few years,
all together, I think it was 8 years maybe. Eight years on and off from the first time I went until I left and that. So
did you see then at a stage, right, this kind of isn't working out, or what happened? Like, what was the journey like there?
I was doing really, really, really well for a long time. I was on the first team squad. I was training the first team at a really young age, 16, 17. And I was an international setup and, you know, thinking, right, things is getting mapped out for me here, and I was excited. I was looking forward to it, but then there was a big culture over there. It was like play hard, party hard. And then at the weekends after games, the boys who didn't want to party hard, who wanted to get their head down or going home to their friends and family, I just got back on the empty digs, or going to meet up with people who want the tickets. And like I say, I had that homesickness and stuff that I was going, I want to go on. Now listen, that's not an excuse, because one thing that I always do is take full responsibility for everything that I've done.
Of course.
But for me at a young age, if I was born in England or Scotland or Wales, that I could have got a train home, it could have been different. But
I mean, you mentioned that discipline thing. It is, I mean, it's ingrained into them, but they definitely had a slight advantage in terms of they could have went home, they could have had Fowlerty figures, you know, someone guiding them, which you didn't have. You're 18, you're out on your own, you've got your own digs, you've got more money than most 18-year-olds will ever have, and you have that opportunity because you're now glamorous, people look up to you, there's girls probably throwing themselves at you, you know.
I think it's really important to say too is that my family were so tight, like, and I had an amazing upbringing. You mean, I have amazing parents, amazing family, and that, and I didn't let them know what was going on, right? So if they knew the extent of what I was doing, both of them would have been on a plane
over
and nailing me. Make no mistake about it. I'm never too big for a nailing, do you know what I mean? So they could only go off what I was saying, and I didn't want to probably worry them, right? So I didn't want to worry them about the homesick, I didn't worry them about the extent that I was partying. And looking back now, if I had a system before, do you know what I mean, or whatever it may be, that's all what ifs and maybes, do you know what I mean? Like I say, in my journey, I'm where I'm at, I'm meant to be here. But I think it's really important to say that I didn't have no guidance. I had an amazing family, I just choose not to let them in what needed to be said, do you know what I mean?
Not that you didn't have guidance, but you're away from home.
It's not like now we can jump
Facebook and
all that
stuff.
At the start, with no mobile phones. Do you know what I mean? That's how I was.
That's it. You were going to a phone box or a phone in the house and phoning home. There's no real connection like you can have now, like jumping on a Zoom call or a Facebook, Facebook Live or whatever. Like, there's none of that connection. There's more connection now, which again, that disconnection that you have from people who are massively important to you, and that guidance, when it's not there, like, you're going to be left to your own devices. And
there's a gap there.
I remember down the phone box one night, and just as you mentioned phone box, speaking to my parents, and how are you getting on, Grand? I'm playing such and such, this, that, and the other. Do you mean, oh, it's good, right, listen, I'll speak to you tomorrow, whatever, I love you, bye-bye. And I put the phone down, and I smashed the phone box up with the phone. Because, I didn't want they let them hear me cry on the phone of how homesick I was. They worry them. So as I'm smashing up the phone box, the police pull up. Whereas if I had been able to, you know, or if I, like I say, when I've talked back to the show, things, you know, when you're able to cope things and speak things. And that was back then, the game's moved on. I suppose life's moved on a bit more now. The people's a bit more open about their feelings and not trying to be as macho or trying to protect themselves and that. But, you know,
especially too, like being away from home, like you're trying to, you've a point to make. You know, you're over there and you want to make it. You want to make it work.
You were the great hope, man. Like everyone in Gaelic, everyone in Derry knew you. Like I don't know football. I don't know fuck all about it. But like I knew you. Do you know what I mean? So, like you were the great hope of not only your family but of the city.
When you're away, like everybody supports anybody that's away across the water, 100%. And they want them to do well. Like, look at the likes of James there. And everybody else now.
And that's a thing. You're seen as that.
Being away
when you're not just that. So and like I say, when I talk to people for a long time and for a huge period of my life, I felt like an actor. Aye. I felt like I was like a performance dealer or an actor. I was always trying to play up to the
football.
Aye, exactly. And essentially at the end, that's probably what got me in the...
It's massive. Like, I just come back to what you're saying there with the likes of Gerard and Owens coming through that academy, and like how they've been conditioned to be able to, like, coping mechanisms.
Yep.
Basically,
exactly.
Like, the way their minds are conditioned led them on to having a full career as a top professional.
Yep.
And if you'd have went through the same process, probably a completely different story.
That's it, but sure.
You kind of spoke about briefly before this started about, you know, fulfillment element of life and, you know, being fulfilled in the role you're doing, and like by the sounds of things, there was almost like an imposter syndrome developing because you were being someone that you weren't really, if you know what I mean. And that only leads to one thing for me. It only leads to like sort of...
sabotage.
By partying, by drinking, usually, or by something else that kind of elicits instant gratification. And it's as simple as that. That's probably, in my mind, anyway, the route that you were going down. And when did the partying kind of become a problem, so to speak?
The party was always there because of the culture, like but I started to get into trouble.
Aye.
Then it was never badness. It was Sandy acting up.
Aye.
Having a bit of fun,
having a bit of crack,
a bit of laugh.
Because I was wee mad Sean from Derry, and the crack was brilliant with him. It was always nearly like performing. I was always end up getting into, and like even like I was done with drink driving and assaulting police officer in England, the assault got dropped. But even the drink driving, it got blown out. I was smashed and all this, that, and the other.
Aye.
I bought a brand new car, custom made car. It was £36,000 or something, right? Which was a lot back then. And there was one of the boys at a birthday party, one of the first teamers. So drove it down, showed them a car, and they're all, "Are you out tonight?" And I said, "Oh, no, listen, I'm taking it easy." No, I'm on. So I parked the car at the bar. I didn't drink and drive. I'm gone out that night, and I got a taxi home, and then next morning, 10, 11 o'clock, whatever it may be in the morning, I've gone back down to get the car.
Right, okay, so it was the next day.
Aye, and
still
on my system. But when people hear the story, it's but again, listen.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. I was done, I took my oil, and you know what, listen, I'm glad it happened because I would never ever get in a car like that again, do you know what I mean? And There is no excuse for it, but again, it's another one of life's lessons that I had to learn the hard way. And again, take my oil, do you know what I mean? I put myself in that situation, I've done it. But here's the thing, is that now I'm a coach at a football club. More importantly, I'm a father. I have, you know what I mean, I've had experiences that I can pass on. You know, the what to do's are the good things, and the what not to do's are the bad things. And, you know, when you're talking from about a life experience, it's kind of...
When you left Liverpool and went to Ipswich, was it felt the right move, right time to do it? Felt good, or was there like a, did you have to overcome something in your head even to go to Ipswich and think, right, why has it not worked at Liverpool? How did it feel basically?
It was a bit of both now, because I know Liverpool were really, really keen on me staying, right? The Northern Ireland manager at the time was assistant manager at Ipswich, and I was on Northern Ireland first team squad at 17. I was captain of the 21s when I was 17. So he's seen big things on me. So two clubs spoke and stuff on that, and I just thought maybe take myself out of the spotlight at the big club, because at the time Ipswich were in the championship. And Ipswich is very small, a lot smaller than Liverpool, really, really quiet, beautiful place. And I thought maybe going there might help settle me down and calm me down and stuff. So going down there and bought a house, and I thought, right, listen, that's going to get myself settled down now. And but it wasn't too long after I was there that I realised, because Ipswich is small, they idolise their footballers. Absolutely idolise them. I couldn't go in there to restaurant and pay for food. I couldn't go into a bar and pay for a pint.
It's
brilliant when you're doing it in moderation. You know what I mean? But it never left, because even though still then I was only 20, 21, still young, still learning, do you know what I mean? So I thought I was doing it for the right reasons. It's just things just continued and carried on, and like I say, they carried on because they're meant to carry on. So the decisions that I was making, I was thinking I was doing for the right reasons. Ultimately, I come back and hit that self-destruct button again.
How long were you up switching, Sean?
3 years. I had a new offer on the table, really good offer. It would have set me up for quite a while. And I, before the Wednesday, before the contract was signing, the drink driving happened on the Sunday.
And that's what played all then?
Yep, and that was kind of... Now, beforehand, there was an R player who did the same thing. Drink driving without a license. The club stood by him, and then we had a couple of Dutch fellas who were in the media for stuff that happened with gears and stuff. I think there was a couple of maybe rip charges up against Demons, which were dropped then, but Ipswich was getting a lot of bad publicity at the time. And then players were regular first team players, and I was young and coming through, and that I know on high hopes. So, and to be fair to them, they had to make a stand at some stage. They said, listen, we're going to end up in a bud, and it was me. And and like I say, that's not an excuse.
Right.
I've done what I've done. I take my oil and move on. It's just
come back in after that, Sean.
I come back. Listen, to be honest with you, I took the easy option. I had a host of clubs offer me deals. You know what I mean? Listen, a team offered me a great deal. JC Rota in Holland, new house, new car, really, really good contract, 3-year deal. Everything I wanted. QPR at all, no big teams in that. And I thought, no, listen, I'll go home and spend some time with family, get my head together. But to be honest with you, deep down, I knew when I was going home.
You weren't coming back.
I wasn't coming back.
Right.
You know, so and that was it. And so it's
so like from there, then coming back. So like England, coming back from Ipswich, and then coming back to Ireland again. But did you sign with Derry?
Derry.
Coming back.
Well, I actually quit football. I quit football for about 6 months. Didn't play. Didn't want to look at it. Quigley's Point, Brian Bale. Come on down and play. I says, no, I'm not coming down. I'm done with it. About the front, grass and Gaelic, and I've been kicking a ball around my brothers. And I come over and, mom, I said, I'm done. Leave me alone. I'm done with it. Like, and I knew him, I had friends. I said, leave me alone. He said, listen, we've 6 matches left. He says, this is a true story. He says, we've never ever won the league. He says, come down, I'll throw you a few pound. We play on a Sunday, and all you can eat and drink on a Sunday after a game. I says, I'll be down on Sunday. Swear to God, that was it. And
you got your love back a wee bit?
And I got plenty of drink on the Saturday and the Sunday. And that's kind of just where it was at then. And I went back, and I went down, and I played them games and that. And then next thing, the NKF man out there, he said, listen, Sean, when do you come in and give it a blast? And I did, and I had a couple of good years at Derry and stuff and that, and we won the FA Cup, and I won a few individual awards and stuff on that. And so I kind of got me that wee, like I say, I've never ever been out of football apart from that wee spell. But it's in me, you know. So that's kind of when I come back, what happened.
So going from having that kind of contract presented to the basically setting you up for life, if you had obviously signed it. Where do you see that as being a good change in your life now, because where you're at? Like, because obviously you would have had the money, you still would have been away from home, and as I think you said to me before this actually started, God knows where you would have ended up if you had fulfilled your potentials as a footballer.
I genuinely, hand on heart, think if I had fulfilled my potential, I'd be dead. Obviously I didn't have the coping mechanisms. I wasn't mentally strong enough. And that's all right. Some people just develop later than others. I was just there early, young and naive and stuff like that. But I genuinely think it, and because now, like I say, it's more, a lot of stuff about the mental health, a lot of stuff is about, you know, all these different things that comes along and not just turning up and kicking a ball. That still wasn't there then. And just the path that I was on, I genuinely don't think I'd be here if that was the case. So it was a blessing in disguise now looking back, but you know, at least I'm kind of
still here.
At least I'm still here.
So did you see that as a problem, like a massive problem that was kind of evolving when you were back here playing in the FAA or Irish League? Did you see that kind of that culture was keeping you trapped, or when did you see that it was a problem? So you said that if you had fulfilled your potential, you probably would have been dead.
So
did you see that? Was it drink, or was it the partying, or whatever it was?
Everything.
Did you see that becoming a mass problem?
Everything. I was like, if somebody wanted to go out, I'm going out. Do you know what I mean? If nobody wanted to go out, I'm going out. You know, when people say to me about hangers on and stuff like this here, I'm not having that. Do you know what I mean? I chose, I made the decisions, I'm going out. I probably was hanging on to people. They could get somebody go out with me. Aye, do you know what I mean? It's you know, you can sit and turn around and say, ah, God, no, I know people talking about it. You didn't.
No,
I knew what I was doing, do you know what I mean? I knew exactly what I was doing. I was self-destructing. Maybe for a while I didn't know. Maybe I just thought I was just partying and having a bit of crack, because that's what everybody else done. But looking back now, with an older head and a wiser head, I realised that a lot of the things that happened was me hitting self-destruct. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of boom on an instinct. And
so what was that point? Like, what was the biggest obstacle in that whole journey that you came to a realisation that right now I have to change, or something has to change?
I got a really bad arm injury. So I've got 3 plates and 57 pins and screws in my arm. Right, so
from football?
No, well, from partying. So you see, like, I have a huge scar there. Right, so I nearly, like, I was in for the operation, and the surgeon says to me, "Follow." Like, he goes, "Listen, an hour and a half. We'll plate him up. We'll get him this, that, and the other." And I remember waking up, and my dad standing beside the bed. I've never seen him that color in my life. He was like a grey white color. And they come up, they couldn't get the clots to stop on my arm.
Jeez.
And so after so many attempts of trying to do it, they were afraid of a clot coming up through my arm and up under my heart, maybe killing me. So he was signing a form to chop off my arm.
Jeez.
I was unaware of all this, and I just remember just how worried he was, do you know what I mean, and stuff. And so that kind of, it scared me a wee bit, but after my spiral then went worse after that, because I was put on prescription meds.
Right.
I was put on tramadol for life, and I was told because of the pain and the severity of the damage, that this is what you'll be on. So I was grand, that's all right. And then I'm addicted to them. You know, I didn't realise, I forgot to reorder my script one time, and I had to wait a weekend, and it was like son of the train spotting. You know, you see it in the film and stuff, and all that. I go, whoa. So rather than me going, that's scary, I need to take care of this, I thought,
top up.
I'm never getting that stage again.
Jeez.
So my tolerance levels went higher and higher and higher and higher. So for years, I was just eating them like Smarties. Like, I remember my doctor saying to me, "Sean, what are you taking a day?" And I think I told her about a quarter of what I took, and she started crying. I knew her well. She said, "Sean, that kills an elephant." She goes, "Probably just because you've been so fit over." She goes, "I do not know how you're
still alive."
Aye, and you think even then that I go, I need to sort this out.
The doctor's crying here.
I didn't. I was all, right. Oh, I'm going to get a grip on that. I'm outside, and the wife now turns around and says to me, "What'd she say?" She just says, "I just went off a wee bit."
Aye.
You know, not one day worry her, but again, that fear of that feeling of not having the tablet scared the absolute life out of me. No, that was what I was.
Over a period of time was that? Like, how long did you, when did you see, "Jesus, I'm actually hooked on these things"? Just that weekend?
That week, I didn't know I was hooked. All just knew, because it was a different feeling from ever had. Because when I was in England, you didn't take paracetamol, you didn't take Lemsips, you didn't have nothing. You were clean, your body was clean. Like, so I was, you know. And when I was taking them, I wasn't out partying.
No,
I wasn't out drinking. So I was thinking maybe this is settling me down. It was a confusion there, man. And I was going, and then it got to a point then that, like, I was losing weight and stuff and all, you know, because I had no appetite. But what scared me was that I stopped feeling. So I stopped now.
I know what you mean, emotionally.
Emotionally, big time.
Anything.
Now I'm a crier. Make no mistake about it. Like, I'll cry at TV ads, I'll cry at X Factor, I'll cry at cartoons with the Waynes. If I'm watching a film and I see somebody happy, I'll cry. I'm honestly proper soft young fella. And I've always been like that. And I know I'm always going to be like that, and that's all right. And I stopped having them feelings. I wasn't happy, I wasn't sad. I was nothing. I didn't feel nothing. I didn't give nothing to nobody in terms of emotional support or love. I thought I was, but I know now, being clean now for a long time, that there's a difference in saying something and showing it. But people feel it off you too. So I need to have a real look at that. Like, but I had I crashed a van, and one of the jobs was working. And the van went over like this kind of this drop, and the van flipped about 6 or 7 times. I knew what I was saying about your life goes in slow motion. I used to laugh at that. Mine's went in slow motion. I genuinely was able to, like, I had a sister who died, right? I was able to pray to her before the van stopped flipping. I thought I was dead. I thought I'm gone here. So I was able to say to her, look after my kids, look after her parents, look after my brothers. And I was able to say everything I had to say. Now, I must have said it really fast, but to me it felt like a lifetime, right? And next thing, van stops, crushed up. I'm hunched over the big transit van, squashed way up, upside down. And the next couple of seconds terrified me because I thought, oh, I'm alive here. And
I'm not getting out.
The smoke was coming on. I thought, I need to get out. But I couldn't move. But it was, I was afraid to move in case I couldn't. Do you know what I mean? I thought, what? And then, fuck. So it's moving finger. Fingers are working. Wrists, arms are working. Fucking, I'm grand here. So I had to smash the glass and climb out. And I climbed out. Somebody had seen it and phoned an ambulance. The ambulance come down. And the ambulance men were freaked out. The damage in the van. And then there's me standing there, blood all over my face. I think me have a hard head. My head smashed the window screen or something, right? The blood all over my face. I thought, so I thought I must be in shock because of the severity of the damage. So they phoned another ambulance. They were afraid they'd put me in or touch me. So they phoned another two ambulances looking at me. I said, what are you?
Anybody
going to
fix me?
What's happening here? So I'm standing here going, what the fuck's going on? And so they took me to the back ambulance now and took me down, and I'm sitting in Letterkenny Hospital. And I swear to God, this is crazy. I remember sitting thinking, where's my tramadols?
That's all you were kind of worried about?
I walked out of the hospital. Didn't get my brain scan done on. Went back down, it was only a 10-minute walk. And van still smoking. And climbed back in.
To get your tramadol?
To get me from my tramadols. Now, you survived death to climb back in for a strip of tablets.
That's crazy.
That's insane. Mental. And...
So what was it like then, getting off tramadols? What was that, a big obstacle for you, or
that's the hardest thing I've ever done, because I remember sitting in the house one day and I just thought, I'm thinking about the things I've just said there, and I'm thinking about my family, and I was nearly like, you know, before I tried to wean off them, I tried to cut down on them, I tried everything, I was trying everything but not trying hard enough, but I was trying and I knew I needed help. So I thought, listen, I can't do it on my own, so I thought, right, rehab. I didn't tell nobody. Went, organised, sort of booted. Told a wife, I'm away for a month here. Told a family, they're all looking at me, you're away for a month. And I says, listen, this is where I'm at. And off I go. But I knew that was my decision for me to do it for me.
Aye.
I went, you know, and then I went. And the doctor says to me, listen, I'm going cold turkey. He says, don't, way too dangerous, which now I know work with me. Almost people with addictions, the seizures and stuff, you know.
That could possibly happen after.
It could kill you. I see him on a daily through work. And I says, no, because I'd made that decision. Even though it was a bad decision because of how dangerous it was, I've made that decision. If you give me something here, I'm going to either get addicted to that or see it as a fix for this. And I just thought, I'm going to just have to buckle on the seatbelt and ride this fucker out, like. And I think I had, I'm not sure exactly, right, because the days were all Monday morning. I couldn't sleep, so I didn't sleep for weeks. And I must have looked like a right psycho, because seeing some of our counselling sessions and some of the group sessions, I'd have been sitting with tracksuit, body warmer, coat, hat, gloves, right? And you might have went to the toilet and come back, and I'd be sitting in my boxer shorts, sweat slashing off me, hot and cold. I just body, just completely fucked, right? But the one thing I did learn on there was I learned so much about myself because I accepted what was happening. And then I started listening to people. And the only thing, the game changer for me was, there's like family days in rehab, right? And they bring your family in. I remember looking out the window and you could see them all walking, and I couldn't wait to see them, because I've seen these before. If I'm going away on a Thursday and I'm back on a Sunday, I'm still crying, because that's how tight it was. So I hadn't seen him in maybe a week at this stage. And then they are coming in, walking in the car park, waving out, and I'm going, happy days, they're bringing me down my sweets and all, and get hugs and all this here, right? Because, you know, it's not a nice place, like. And then they go on to the counsellors, and I don't know what the counsellors tell them on there, but they prime them up to tell you some nasty shit. They hit hard, and they hit where it hurts. And I swear to God, it was like walking on the lion's den, right? And by fuck, but I get it. And I remember trying to apologise to my ma. I'd never swear at my mum, right? I wouldn't. It's not me. I'm as mad as I can be. I was brought up really good with manners and stuff, you know. I'm good like that. I just kept saying there, go fuck and listen to me, go fuck up, right? And I didn't realise exactly what I was doing. I was trying to say sorry for what I put her through, but I kept cutting her off and swearing, and I couldn't get the words out. And I was just coming out 100 miles an hour because I was just saying about I was just instinct, boom, boom, boom. And then the brawler Emmett, he turned around and one of them and just says, listen, you used to be my hero. He says, no, I don't want you around me or my kids. And I was like someone sticking a knife in my heart. Like, and I think that second was the time it changed.
Switched for you.
Everything changed. So, and even after that, then the family gone out or whatever, and I remember I was sitting, having made dinner with the rest of the people in there, and nobody could look at me, nobody could talk to me. I was in a daze. But it hurt me. I remember saying to you, I had no feelings. I felt.
Back. Got the emotion back.
I felt. And I was all.
It was the best thing could happen.
I says, I have a fucking chance here. And from that day on, not from that day on because I've done cold turkey, but I've been cleaning on that since. And but that was, I was a game changer. Like,
do you think it's crazy? Like, if you think that if they hadn't done that process, would the change
have been
would the change have been as profound, or would the change have happened? Like, if they hadn't come in and actually said those things to you, you probably have thought that, well, you know what, sure, just go back out. It's been accepted anyway, and it's okay.
Because
obviously there for a reason, but they're
100%. It's part of rehab. Yeah. It's part of rehab, and I get why, right? And
for both sides, for possibly.
And another thing is too is that I used to always just think, because I was saying about the self-destruct, I never thought I was hurting anybody else except me. It was me jeopardising careers. It was me jeopardising relationships. It was me blowing all my money. It was me. It was stuff that I just thought, I'm not hurting anybody else really, because I'm a good fella and I'm good crack and I'm wee Sean having a fucking, you know what I mean? But I realised quickly there that, especially in addiction, the actual family around it suffers far more. And for me, being so close to my family and so close to my group of friends, that was an all eye opener to me that, jeez, I'm really hurting people who I'm supposed to love. Now, nobody will tell me that I didn't love them, do you know what I mean, then, because I love them with all my heart. I love them more, and I think they love me more now because of the journey of what's come through. So that was brutal. But while I was on there, a few things happened, like meditation. From the minute I was on there, I used to meditate in the morning, meditate at night. And years and years and years now I'm out, I still do the same thing because that's a part of my healing. That sets me up for the day. It makes me realise that, listen, slow down, breathe, pay attention to what's going on. It's not all helpers
can do.
Makes you present, is right. It makes you more self-aware and more aware of what's around you. So wee things I got to talk, and then I started reading, but I started listening. I never used to listen because I was always just on the go. So I just started to listen, and I took all the wee things. I'm going to come out of there, I understood myself. I understood what made me tick in a good way, and I understood what made me tick in a bad way. So it was able then now to start separating this.
Avoiding the bad stuff.
Exactly.
Calling the good.
And then I surrounded myself, and saying about hangers on, and this, that, and the other, like I said, and I was drawing people on to hang on to the party. I come out and I text all the people. Not that it wasn't important, maybe, because when you're like steady, you have a large group of friends, and he's dead on, they're dead sound and stuff, and they're nice people. And I still see him and say, oh, how's things, how are you getting on, grand, or whatever it is, right? But I just didn't need them in my life at that time. So I just texted, listen, just out of rehab, get my shit together. Don't be offering me no tablets and that. I'm done. I'm out. Do me a favour, please, listen. I'll say hello, not only to yourself, it's me, this is what I need to do. And everybody was amazing, they were brilliant with it. And so I kind of thought, right, there's a good step, and surrounded myself with important people, the people who wouldn't lie to me or bullshit me, people who keep me in line, but the people who knew what I was going through and who would help me through it. So that was a big call.
That quote from that book, Atomic Habits, James Clear, environment is an invisible hand that shapes human behaviour. I think it's a fantastic quote, and it makes fucking so much sense.
Surround yourself.
When you're in that, you don't realise the environment you're in, because you want to be in it. And it's only until something like that happens, you're like, right, I can't be in that environment anymore.
Because it's not good.
The person that you come out of rehab would have repelled naturally anyway, them people that you're talking about. I feel you are attracted, like, you attract like people, if that makes sense. So the hangers on you're talking about were more like you than anyone else. And that's why they were attracted to you. Simple as. And you are the person that does create that environment to me, in a way.
It's 100%. It's, you know, it's that's some deep stuff, isn't it? Like,
it is, man.
But at the end of the day, it's that's stuff that I wouldn't understood.
No.
Yeah.
No, that's it. Do you know what I mean? How you were able to kind of slow it down and think. And
we're all, like, and that's the thing about it, is they are, a lot of the habits that we have are unconscious. We're not aware of them, and they're so self-destructive. And until we go through what you've went through and all our episodes that you've went through, and you realise, right, well, these destructive habits and patterns that I'm repeating over and over again, like, why am I doing that? And I need to actually change it. But it takes sometimes that state of desperation that, right, no, enough's enough. I have to change it.
Exactly. It's
a fucking amazing story, man. Like, where are you at right now? Like, because it sounds like you're in a better place in terms of fulfillment of your life. Like, I know you had everything, I suppose, that every young boy dreams of. Like, go to a fucking Premiership club, and you had the fame and popularity, money. Like, where are you at right now in life?
I'm in a really, really good place. Like I said these before we started this here, that I was always just known as a footballer. Right? So, and I was saying these before, and while I was in England, all my girlfriends have all been from Derry.
From here.
Because I didn't know who wanted to be with Sean the footballer, because I was just a footballer. I'm married. Married Mayor and my first girlfriend, who I met the first day of school. So with four kids between us, right there in May, back and forth with football, assistant manager, institute, and I work with homeless people and people with addictions, which is nearly like my therapy and rehab every day. No matter what I take on, they work or wake up with, or whatever is going on, I know that if I go back to the ways I did, I'll need someone like me to work with me, because I'll end up like that, and that's so. For me, it's not only is it giving back; it's me putting myself in the position to keep me aware of what I need to be at, and I get to go home to my family, alive and feeling, and I love my job. I love my job. Like, it's the people that I work with don't get. Respect people, look at homeless people, and people look at people with addictions, and because I have it first hand and an experience of it, I know. And listen, it's normally I see it myself when I'm taking some of the people key work and stuff, when I'm taking them to their appointments or wherever it may be, or and I'm walking through town with them, I can see people looking to come over and say hello to me, but they're afraid they come over because of who I'm with. They can't cross the street and they're looking, they'll give you a wee wave and they'll put their head down, and it's understandable because they don't know, there's a wee bit of intimidation here. But they're just people, exactly the same as us.
Yeah.
And
stuck on a pattern.
And do you know what? Listen, it might not just be their own choice. It could be a lot of us from trauma that's happened before.
Yeah.
The mental health side of things, and a lot of the mental health and addiction goes hand in hand. So it's a far, far bigger picture than what people, I think, really, really understand.
Out of that, Sean, like, what is it that you love most about that? Like, what is it that you love doing in and around that area? Like, with those people?
Helping.
Just help
me
give them back.
If I didn't get it, I wouldn't be here talking these.
Right.
So it's that help, and see something as small as if we're going to a meeting, right? I'm taking someone out, and I say to them, "Mo Conde Costa for a coffee." That's out of their realm. That's not normal to them. They didn't get to go into it.
No, exactly.
See the smile on their face. They get to do something normal, right? Is nice, but because of saying on the outside world, they have people who are intimidated by them, or who maybe fear them a wee bit, or don't look down at them, or give them a time of day. And again, I get it. It's understandable, because some people just don't understand. See, just knowing, I know that they look at me not just as a key worker, but they look at me as someone who cares about them. And that's something that's nice, like.
That's shit that you can't buy, like.
Yep.
To be able to fix a problem that you had yourself, like, you know how much that's going to change their life. Like, I suppose, even when we talk to personal trainers, when we talk about their avatar, they talk about themselves 5 years ago, don't they? Every personal trainer, who's your avatar? Well, it's this girl, and she was overweight. And what's your story? Oh, I was overweight about 5 years ago. You know, it's and the same with us. She had a business. Now I try and teach people how to grow their businesses, because they can be happier. Because I know what change it brings in their life.
It's life experience, isn't it?
And that's why it gives you so much fulfillment to do something like
that. And see, even the things that... because of mental health and the addiction side of things, right, that, you know, where I work, is it... it's very, very hard to get people clean and sober. Really hard. A lot of them don't get there, right? But it's in between time is giving them some good memories, or helping them, or knowing if they want to, you're there.
Aye.
Or knowing if they need something, they've got someone they can come and ask. You know, whether it be helping them with their benefits, help them get a house,
yeah,
maybe help them get a counsellor to talk about stuff that's happening. Whatever it may be, at least they know that they've got someone who they can trust and turn around and go, can you help me?
The thing is, Derry is at like a small of a place as well too. You're probably going to know a lot of those people personally anyway.
100%. Listen, 100%. It's crazy the amount of people you do see and do know. And it's not just street drinkers and people you've had. It's a lot of it's people, about confidence, I'm never going to say who it is.
No.
But there's people that you go, whoa,
they'll
tick you back a wee bit, do you know what I mean? But again, we've just gone through my story.
That, exactly.
That ticks people, do you know what I mean? This is real life, it doesn't pick and choose.
No.
I'll go where, because he'll be an easy one. That's not it, it's real life. People talk about mental health, we talk about mindset and things.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's completely different. Some people are able to deal with it, some people aren't. But just because you can't deal with it right now, doesn't mean you're done.
Yeah.
You can, if you get the support to help
and
know your path.
Yeah,
you know.
100%.
What you're doing is giving people that hope.
Aye.
Like by showing up and like being you and giving them your experience and helping them out and sharing that fucking love with them. Like giving them that
hope.
Bit of hope that they probably don't have.
Hope's a while, because for too long they don't have it. I know that myself. If you don't have hope, where do you go?
Yeah.
Probably if you don't have hope, a lot of people are over that bridge or do something else.
100%.
So where are you at now, heading forward, Sean? You're still coaching in football with Stuart.
Yeah.
Enjoying that process.
Loving it. It challenges my head. Like, it's not like just turning up and playing. I have to think about formations. I got to think about players. I got to pair and players up, you know, and you sit down with the manager and the other coaching staff and strategies and get your brain working. Family, life, my work. Going to the gym, trying to set myself wee goals, challenging myself all the time, just anything to keep myself busy. But I'm very, very fortunate with keeping me busy. It's all the stuff I love.
Yeah.
And now, like I was saying before, and I've said a few things that I've been chatting in the past, is I'm no longer Sean the footballer. I'm now Sean, the daddy, the support worker, football coach.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I'm more now than just an actor on a big football pitch.
Brilliant.
Which is nice.
Guys, just want to say a massive thanks to Sean for actually hopping in on this podcast. Amazing story. Like, fucking literally hair standing on my fucking arms. Nearly crying at 1.2, but we're not even making it. I think there was something in my eye, to be fair. But I really appreciate you coming on, man. And what you're doing now is unbelievable, especially as a sport worker and a coach of Institute, because I know they need all the help they can get. But anyway, appreciate it, bud, for me and Seamus, and the Elevate, bud.
No problem. Man, listen, I really appreciate you having me on. Thanks very much.